class. Where did we end last class? Anybody remember? Did we read through Perikop Aleph, the whole Perik?
We were reading the battle of Aleph. Let's see,
Aleph. Yeah. Aleph is the story of the Gibbonim. Did we read it through?
Yeah. We were reading that, and we read the plotting, the nasty plotting.
Did we actually read the whole story of the Gibbonim and David and appeasement and handing over seven children, the grandchildren of Shaul?
Yes, we did.
We did. Okay. So, I think we probably left off. It used to be hard enough for me to keep track of Monday, Wednesday. Now it's even harder because I'm just not sure where I'm holding and what. So, I believe we ended up with a bunch of questions, correct?
Who are the killers?
Why did David participate in this plan of the Givonim to take revenge against Shaul? Why did Shaul kill the Givonim in the first place, correct? Is that the story?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, trying to identify who were the assassinators.
Which assassinators are you talking about?
There are two people who were involved.
Oh, okay. So we'll come back to Perek Dalet eventually. We'll come back to Rechav and Baana eventually. Right now, I want to focus on Perek Chaf Aleph. Again, you have to separate these two stories. The two people who killed Shaul are in Perek Dalet.
Oh, okay.
The text tells us that they are from the city of Be'erot. We discovered that Be'erot is one of the cities of the Givonim. I took us out to Perikop Aleph to read the story of the Givonim, separate from the story of Rechav and Baana. So we're going on a digression,
exactly, right.
A completely separate story. We'll eventually come back to Rechav and Baana, but for now, our focus is on this story of Perik Dalet. Little bit of feedback. So what I'm going to do with your permission is mute the mics, but I will, but please feel free to chime in. Just unmute yourself, hold the space bar down and it'll unmute. Then you can let go and it'll go back to being muted. So you can kind of very easily, you don't have to go clicking buttons and moving mice. You just hold the space bar while you speak, like a microphone button, and it'll unmute you. Right. It's like holding down a microphone button. You just hold it down while you speak. Old-fashioned microphones that had a little button on it, and you had to hold them when you wanted to speak. Yes? Works? Can you test it?
All testing, right. Rabbi, testing.
There you go. Testing works.
Oh, does work. Well done.
Okay. So, I want to come back to Perikop Aleph, and this is the story of the Givonim, and obviously there are some big questions that need to be addressed. There's a famine in the land for 3 years. David seeks out God's counsel. So this whole story is operating with a divine stamp of approval. God's answer to David is that the reason for this famine is because of Shaul. And because of the blood of him having killed the Givonim, which is tantamount to saying to David, go appease the Givonim, whatever they tell you, that's what's going to have to happen. And in fact, at the end of the story, after the Givonim are appeased, and after Shaul is reburied, etc., the text does say, at the very end, Vayi'ater Elokim la'aretz achrechen, that God entreated the land, meaning that God responded with rain and ended the famine because of the circumstances of this parak. So whatever happens seems to have the divine approval that David was seeking, even though it sounds like or reads like a very harsh story. So on the one hand, mystery number one is this story of Shaul killing all the Givonim, we have no record of in the Navi, in the Tanakh, other than the reference here, which is a reference in hindsight. So it's an event that took place, we don't know when. And because it has such far-reaching consequences, we need to have more information about what it was, when did it occur, and why. That's part one. Part two, right, and sorry, just to finish up with part one, the reference to Shaul for having killed the Givonim is repeated in Pasuk Bet, where it says, where it tells us the background, the Givonim, they're not Israelites, rather they are Canaanites, Mieto Ha'emorim. And Israel had taken an oath of loyalty to them, although an oath in under false pretenses, but nonetheless an oath of loyalty to them. But Shaul sought to destroy them in his zeal for Israel and Judah. And that's the reference to the second time, that Shaul tried to kill them out of some kind of zeal for Bnei Yisrael v'Yehuda. We need to explore that piece of the story to better understand Shaul's motivation. That's part one of the mystery. Part two of the mystery is the response. The Givonim say we want seven of Shaul's descendants, and David seems to be forced to hand them over, seven of Shaul's descendants. Which seven is a question. Why he spares Mephibosheth ben Yonatan is a point of interest and maybe significance, because he had taken an oath of loyalty to Yonatan. But nonetheless, he takes seven of Shaul's grandchildren, children and grandchildren, and hands them over to the Givonim. And of course, knowing full well that the Givonim are going to kill them, the Givonim hang them and kill them very publicly, all seven, in a place called in Givat Shaul, or hang them in Givat Shaul, which is either Givon or possibly part of the Givat Shaul, unclear. And then you have the postscript part of the story, which is Rizpah bat Aya, who sits for 6 months to protect the carcasses of these seven children, seven descendants, so that they should not become they should not be violated by the birds of prey. And David hears the honor that she bestowed upon these, on the bodies, realizes that he didn't properly address the kavod to the bodies of not only these seven, but also of Shaul and Yonatan. And so immediately he goes and he reclaims the bodies, the bones of Shaul and Yonatan from Yavesh Gilad in order to give them state funeral in their hometown of Givat Shaul. So there's a second part of this story, which is the kavod given to Shaul, Yonatan, and the bodies of these seven people who were killed. And only after that does God respond, Vayater Elokim la'aretz achrechem. This two parts of the story lead Chazal to make what seems to be a very odd statement, but nonetheless one that is quoted by Rashi and the Rishonim. And I'm going to jump to the source page now, so give me a moment. We're going to jump to here. And that is this statement of the Gemara in Yevamos, where the Gemara says, "Vayomer Hashem," when God says to David that the reason for the famine is Shaul and Beit Hadamim and the blood on his hands for the Givonim, Chazal saw that as two statements. They parse the phrase, "El Shaul," the famine for Shaul, meaning on behalf of the fact that Shaul was not given proper honor. He wasn't given the proper honor of being properly buried. Number one. And number two, and also the fact that that he killed the Givonim. So the famine has two causes. One is Shaul's crime, and the other is that Shaul wasn't given proper respect. So that was the last question that I asked, which is that it seems to be a kind of contradiction. Is it to Shaul's credit, we're defending Shaul's honor, right? Is it the honor of Shaul that we are engaged in trying to protect here, or is it an indictment of Shaul that we're trying to rectify? To suggest that it's both is really very, very difficult. So all of this is background to Perachav Aleph, in the story of the Givonim, Shaul and the Givonim. Somehow I've made the somewhat mysterious claim that all of this is background to Perek Dalet and the story of Rechav and Bana, which we will eventually come back to probably next week. Okay, so for today, what I wanted to do is try to explore the story of the Givonim. What happened? When did Shaul deal this blow to the Givonim and why? And I think we read this, the Perek in Yehoshua, correct? Where Yehoshua, the Givonim disguise themselves and they come running to Yehoshua, and Yehoshua, they, under false pretense, they claim that they're from a faraway land. And ultimately, what happens is that they're forced to take an oath of loyalty to the Givonim, that then they discover that they're really from four local cities, Givon, Beirut, Kiryat Yearim, etc. And they decide, and this is particularly important for us, after 3 days, it was discovered that the Givonim are local, and that they're not, that they live in their midst. They went, they found them in the cities, Givon, Kfira, Beirut, Kiryat Yearim. However, instead of attacking them and killing them, Lo hikum b'nei Yisrael, they did not smite them, they did not exact retribution against them. Why? Because the elders of Israel had taken an oath in God's name. And if you take an oath in God's name and violate that oath, that becomes a chilul Hashem. And the people come to Ba'ilonu Koleidal and Nisim. The people came to the Nisim and murmured against them. They said, well, these people, the Canaanites, they're going to live in our midst. They're going to be a thorn in their side. And the Nisim answered and they said, Anachnu nishbanu lehem b'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. We took an oath in God's name. Lo nuchal lingoa b'hem. We can't touch them. So instead, they gave them a job in the context of the tabernacle, Mishkan, world to be the hewers of wood and drawers of water, the chotvei etz and moshav v'mayim, and that was how they remained for hundreds of years. This oath is very important because if Shaul goes to kill them or attack them, then what has Shaul done?
Breaches the oath.
Right, he breaches the oath, and that creates the potential for Chilul Hashem, and at least according to the Radak, one who suggests that that's part of the crime here, is the Chilul Hashem factor is very significant. I'll come back to the oath a little bit later, but for now, the bigger question I want to start with is, when and why does Shaul attack the Givonim? Again, this is a story that does not appear in the text of Tanakh. So we are in the world of conjecture. But when and why does Shaul attack the Givonim? So coming back to the Gemara suggests, "V'chehechan matzinu b'Shaul shemitu Givonim." When do we ever find that Shaul smote the Givonim? Answers Chazal, "Mitoch sheharag nov ir hakonim shayu maspikim lehem mayim umazon." Because Shaul killed Nov, the city of the Kohanim, including the destruction of the tabernacle at that time where the Mizbeach was in Nov. And Nov, serving the Mizbeach, was their source of Parnassa. They were designated to be, had to have a certain professional guild inside the context of the tabernacle. Close the tabernacle, destroy the Mizbeach, and kill all the Kohanim, and you essentially shut down their source of Parnassa. So the Gemara says, Shaul didn't actually kill the Givonim, says Chazal. says the Gemara in Yavamas. He just killed Nov the Kohanim. He killed the city of Nov. But the Givonim paid a price for it. And they ended up having to move, and they ended up having to leave. And so it was as if Shaul had perpetrated this crime against the Kohanim themselves, against the people of the Givonim themselves. So says the Gemara in Yevamos. There's another suggestion that's brought down in the Yerushalmi, which I don't have on the source page, but Rashi quotes both opinions. And the other opinion is also connected to Nov. Rashi says, when Shaul killed the city of Nov, Hemit mehem shiva. There were seven givonim that were there, and they were also killed. Two water drawers, wood cutters, chotve etzim. Two water drawers, shnei shoavimayim. Shamash, chazan v'sofer. Shamash, chazan and sofer, meaning various communal roles, the leader and the scribe, etc. So you count it together. There are seven people who make up the communal leadership of the Givonim. They would have been in the city of Nov. If he killed the city of Nov, he would have killed them as well. Kach mefurash b'gemara Yerushalmit b'Sanhedrin. Why does the Gemara assume that there are seven that Givonim were killed? Sounds to me like there are many more. It sounds to me like it. The text said, "He mit et ha-givonim," that he killed all the givonim. Why does the Gemara limit it only to the killing of seven? Where does the Gemara draw the number seven from?
Because that's the number of people David handed over.
Correct, because that's the number of people the givonim requested. Sort of an eye for an eye, a soul for a soul kind of thing. Because otherwise it's a little bit of a mystery why the Givonim are satisfied with the number seven. They can't have seven descendants. There's another possibility as to why the number seven, and that could be that there were, that they didn't actually request seven, they requested the descendants of Shaul, and there were outside of Mephibosheth and Ishbosheth, there are only seven. So David hands over the ones that are available, so to speak. We'll come back to the question of why those seven. And then the second opinion Rashi quotes is the one that I showed you earlier, Gemara in Yevamos. Both of these opinions work off the assumption that the murder of the Givonim is tied to Shaul's wrath against the city of Nov, which he destroyed because he felt they were giving safe harbor to David as David was running or fleeing from Shaul's paranoia. So it all comes down to a period of time when Shaul has already lost his grip on the Malchus, killed, already committed a crime of blood on his hands by killing Nov. And so Chazal sort of took the story of the Givonim and assumed if it was a crime that God is holding him accountable for, it must have in some way been linked to the crime of the Givon of Nov, which is another instance of Shaul's blood on his hands, of Shaul having blood on his hands of innocent victims. That is option one.
Rabbi?
Yeah?
Sorry, can you just help me understand how you square Rashi and the Gemara when one says it's just, the Gemara says it's figuratively that he's talking about killing?
Well, Rashi quotes both. Taking away their, quotes both opinions. I have two different Gemara sources. I have a Gemara in the Yerushalmi and I have a Gemara in the Bavli. And they differ. So Rashi quotes, they both, what they have in common is they both link the Givonim, the story of the Givonim to the murder of the city of Nov.
So you got a common denominator.
That's the common denominator between the two opinions. The difference between them is that to the Bavli, the story of the Givonim is that they were harmed. They were impacted negatively by the destruction of Nov, and the text is judging Shaul harshly for it. In the Yerushalmi, there's actual blood that Shaul killed, that Shaul spilled. But both of them link the story to the story of Nov. Rashi's working off the assumption that in some way this event of the Givonim is linked to the city of Nov. And I have two opinions. I have a Yerushalmi and a Babli of how to navigate that. So he quotes both. Right?
Got it.
Okay. Similar approach is taken by some of the other Mefarshim. But overall, that is a, if you look at the Malbim, for example, the Malbim also says it's connected to the city of Nov, but he gives a little bit of a twist. He says, there's a weakness in Chazal's interpretation. And the weakness is that in the text in Perchof Aleph, it says that Shaul killed the Givonim. According to the Bavli, according to the Yerushalmi, he didn't kill the Givonim. He either killed seven, who happened to be a Nov, or he didn't kill anybody. He just kind of impacted, he negatively impacted their parnasa. But that's very different from what the text says. The text says, Al Shaul ve'al Beit Adamim al asher he mit et ha-givonim, because he put the Givonim to death. And so it's a little bit of a difficulty to suggest that it's somehow connected to Nov. And furthermore, the text says that Shaul did so out of zeal. Kanato livnei Yisrael v'Yudah. Did so out of zeal for Israel and Judah. Why did Shaul kill the city of Nov? Why did Shaul kill the Kohanim of Nov?
Because they were helping out David.
Because they were helping out David. It was an act of vengeance. Vengeance is different than zeal for Israel and Judah. In Parakhof Aleph, the text says that he did so out of zeal for the children of Israel and for Judah. Killing Nov because he was somehow saw them as aiding and abetting David, who at that point in his in Shaul's perverted worldview, David was committing treason. But that's not zeal for Israel and Judah. That's personal vengeance. So to link the story of the Givonim to the story of Nov is possible but weak. And Chazal do it because Chazal felt that that was where Shaul's moral crime was most clear, and we don't have any other evidence to him killing the Givonim, so they must be connected. But this reference to Kinatob Livnei Yisrael v'Yudah is more problematic. So, based on that, we have an alternative explanation. Some of the Rishonim suggest that Shaul's behavior towards the Givonim had nothing to do with Nov. Okay, so we're going to Rishonim that are going to interpret the text not in accordance with the Gemara at all. We're going to give a pshat-oriented interpretation that's independent of the Gemara. And that is as follows. So here I'll give you two possibilities. Marikara. This is his interpretation in Perikov Aleph, why the text tells us that Shaul killed the Givonim. Shagivonim lo mibnei Yisrael, elheim ma'im yeter ha'imoni yibnei Yisrael nishbu lehem, v'yibakesh Shaul lahakotam b'kinato b'nei Yisrael b'Yudah. That's the pasuk that I just read, that he did so out of zeal for Israel and Judah. When was this? Says Marikara, ze aya kishemalach a Yisrael b'Yudah. This was early, when Shaul reigned over the united kingdom of Israel and Judah. And lo aval kabel lav shvua shenishba'u lehem nesiyei ha'ida b'dorosh Yoshua. And he did not feel himself bound by the policy oath of the 400-year-old oath of the Nesiyim to the Givonim. He didn't feel himself bound by that oath. Yeshaba Shaul Amar Shvu'a Zu Nishbu'a Nisiyim Arishanim Lachiyotam. Shaul said, this oath that the Nisiyim had taken, doesn't apply to me. But rather, Mitzvah lo techayah kol neshama. I've got to go back to the biblical mandate, which was to clear the land of all the Canaanites and all the idolatries. And therefore, it's my responsibility, it's part of my purge of the idolatry in the land, to get rid of them. So vayigar Hashem Shaul vayashmidem mitzvah b'chol gvul Yisrael. So he expelled them. And those who didn't want to leave, he destroyed. And he violated the Shavuah that the Nesi'im had made at that time. So Yosef, Marie Kara suggests that this behavior of Shaul has nothing to do with Nov. In fact, it's much earlier. It's very early in his reign when he becomes king. And now he sees the Givonim and he sees that they're Canaanites and idolatrous, and he's trying to purge the land of the idolatry. And he says, I'm not bound by an oath 400 years ago. My ancestors made an oath to them that was based on false pretense 400 years later. Not bound by it. And he says, you don't belong here. Ralbag makes a similar claim where he says that this was all about the oath, that he felt himself not bound to in days of old. That's a second possibility. That somehow he just, it's a policy change, sort of like Lahavdil, Vayakom Melech Hadash, Shelo Yadat Yosef, when Paro came to power, policy change, Yosef was a good guy, I'm gonna remember him not that way. Shaul comes to power and he says, oh, 400 years, the Givonim have lived here as our allies, as our friends, but the Canaanites of old, our ancestors made an oath of loyalty to them. We're going to change the policy. We're going to change the behavior. I'm not going to see myself bound by agreements of past regimes. Goodbye, Givonim. So says the Rabag and Marie Kara. Again, part of the challenge to all of this is, why now? Why in the days of David does God come and say, we're going to hold Shaul accountable? Shaul is dead, long dead. Haragabah, David is king. So years later, God is going to come to David and say, you know what? I'm going to punish all of Israel now for a crime Shaul committed 30 years ago. It's a mystery. So I leave this mystery as a kind of an open ticket that needs to be explored. The second possibility. So far what we've explored is two possible contexts for when Shaul chose to fight against the Givonim. One is, and the why, right? So it's the when and the why. The first interpretation is Rashi and the Gemara that says that somehow it's connected to Nov, where the Mizbeach was. And when Shaul saw Nov aiding and abetting David, connected the dots, destroyed Nov, destroyed the Kohanim, and with it, the Givonim paid a price. Right? Open parentheses, FYI, after Shaul destroys the altar and the Mizbeach in Nov, where does the Mizbeach move to? Anybody remember? It starts in Shiloh. Well, it starts in Gilgal. The Mishkan goes from Gilgal to Shiloh. Plishtim destroy it in Shiloh, the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, and so the Mishkan has to move. Moves to the city of Nov. In the beginning of Shmuel Bet, Shaul destroys the Mishkan in Nov, and now it has to move again. Its last home before David will finally, eventually bring it to Yerushalayim. Its last home is in the city called Giv'on. Why is that significant? Dude, you look like you're smiling. Why did that
That's who we're dealing with now, right?
Right. In other words, after Shaul destroys Nov, he moves the Mishkan to Givon. So again, I mean, Givon was part of the cities of the Givonim. It could be that Israel was there too, but it's just ironic, and maybe that's why Chazal saw a connection between these two events. It's a possibility.
If the Mishkan moves there, then you have an issue with the Gomorrah that said their livelihood was zapped. Because you destroyed Nov, and all of a sudden now it's in Givon.
Well, the Mishkan does move to Givon. That's a fact. That's an indisputable fact. And the Mizbech is in Givon when David and Shlomo build the Beit HaMikdash. So that's just an irrefutable, that's the way it is. Whether it's connected to the Givonim, the parasha of the Givonim or not, that's debatable. So again, option one, Rashi, Gemara and Yavamas, Yerushalmi, the story of the Givonim is somehow related to the story of Nov. Nov is a crime on Shaul's record. To it, we're going to add the blood of the Givonim. Option one. Option two, Shaul's wrath against the Givonim is not motivated by David, it's not motivated by Nov. It's much earlier, when Shaul first comes to power, and he's now reigning over all of Israel, and he's trying to purge the land of the idolatry. Shaul in his heyday, Shaul in his top of his game, when he's trying to lead the people of Israel and establish Jewish sovereignty in the land and rid the land of its enemies and of the Plishtim and of the Canaanites and of the idolatry. And in that context, sees himself not bound by the oath to the Givonim, destroys the Givonim too. And now, years, decades later, God comes to him and holds him accountable for the lack of loyalty to the Givonim. Option two. I'll share with you a third possibility, which is somewhere in between. The weakness of this second position is that, again, I don't have any objective reason for Shaul's wrath against the Givonim. It's just suddenly Shaul decides 400 years ago the Nisim took an oath to them, I'm not bound by it. And he moves on. It's true that Shaul's attitude towards the oath and the oaths of others, even the oath of himself, right, even oaths that he himself took, Shaul's attitude towards his oaths is somewhat weak. He took an oath, B'Shem Hashem, not to kill David. We know how long that oath lasted. About 5 verses. He took that oath in the Rosh Chodesh party when he was talking to Yonatan. And he says to Yonatan, Chai Hashem, by God, by the living God, I will not harm David. And then 5 psukim later, he threw the spear at him. So clearly, he doesn't see the oath as being as binding an issue as we would. We'll see that that's, at least according to the Radak, part of the substantive issue here. But nonetheless, that by in itself is a hard story to suggest that that's what's driving Shaul, and that Shaul is totally motivated by a desire to rid the land of the Canaanites. Just out of the nowhere, out of the blue, suddenly the Givonim. So here's a third possibility. And the third possibility is that maybe the Givonim did something, to say to Shaul, I'm no longer satisfied that you're keeping up your end of the bargain. Remember, what was the brit with the Givonim? Yehoshua and the Nesi'im made a brit with the Givonim. Namely, what is a brit? What's a brit? By definition, what is a brit?
Covenant, oath.
It's a covenant, it's a contract, right? A covenant, an alliance. Let's call it an alliance. In an alliance, what does a typical alliance feel like, sound like, look like? Make an alliance with somebody. What does it usually mean? Mm-hmm. No, this is not
you science. You share resources or information?
You share resources or information, or usually in alliances between states are typically military alliances. What's sure. A military alliance? If I'm in trouble, I'll help you. And if you're in trouble, if I'm in trouble, you'll help me. And if you're in trouble, I'll help you. Right? It's a bridge. It's an alliance. And that's exactly what the expectation was. The Kifonim came to Yoshua and said, we want an alliance. They agree. They did it under false pretense, and they decide to keep the oath anyway. And that's fine. But then, literally, in the next parak, we find that when Adoni Tzedek, king of Yushalayim, heard that Yoshua had made a deal with the Givonim, what did he do? He went and he surrounded the Givonim. Givon was a great city. It was one of the major royal cities. It was bigger than even Nineveh. So Adoni Tzedek, king of Yushalayim, gathered together all of his forces, and they went and they attacked the city of Givon. So what did the city of Givon do? Vayishlachu anshei Givon al Yoshua. The people of Givon sent a message to Yoshua and said to Yoshua, come quickly, save us. We made a deal. We're being attacked. Come and save us. That's what an alliance is. An alliance is a political military alliance. We're in trouble, you'll fight for us. You're in trouble, we'll fight for you. And proof is there that Yoshua, in fact, does. He goes and he fights against the whole group of the four kings in order to free the Givonim from that attack. This was a full-blown, all-out, legal, political, military alliance, NATO style. We are one national, united, mutual protection alliance. Fair? Yes, agreed? That's what a brit between kings and kingdoms is. Okay. Why do I mention that? Here's a mystery. And I have no resolution to this mystery. You're going to tell me what my problem is. Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Dalet. Actually, let's go back to Perek of Gimel. Second year of Shaul's reign, early. Second year of Shaul's reign, Shaul has 3,000 soldiers, and he takes his 3,000 soldiers, and he places his camp in Michmas, city of Michmas, in Har Beit El, with another 1,000 that belong to Yonatan in Givat Binyamin, and the rest of it he sent home. Vayach Yonatan nitziv plishtim mashir begeva, Yonatan smote the garrison of Philistines in Geva. The plishtim heard, they blew the shofar, and they come running. And Israel came running too, and the plishtim gathered their forces, and Israel gathered their forces, and they have a standoff. Read Pasuk Hey. Uflishtim ne'esfu lilachem im Yisrael. The Philistines gathered together to fight against Israel. Shloshim elef rechev, 30,000 chariots. Sheshet alafim parashim, and 6,000 riders. Va'am kachol asher osfat hayam larov, and a multitude of soldiers like the sand upon the seashore. Vayalu vayachanu b'michmas. They came and they encamped in Michmas. Well, sorry about that. Kidmat Bet Aven, east of Bet Aven. And now Israel is afraid. They don't know what to do. They're hiding in caves and in thickets and in rocks. And they're running away. And this is a 2-chapter-long story called the Battle of Michmas. We studied it at length. In the end, Yonatan attacks the Plishtim. Yonatan is successful. They have a counterattack. Shaul gathers his forces. this is one of those stories where Shmuel had said to him, wait for me to start the battle and offer sacrifices, and he didn't wait. Right, the rest of the story is irrelevant. I'm much more interested in the location of Michmas, because the Philistines gathered this enormous army, 30,000 soldiers, 6,000 riders, and foot soldiers as many as the sand upon the sea, and they come up and they encamp the Michmas, and Israel is in trouble. Now, we win the battle, but I don't know where Michmas is. So let's see where Michmas is and why the text tells me that Michmas is east of Beit Aven. Everybody with me? So let's go to a map. Here's a map. Okay? Here's a map of Israel, just to get us a perspective. Here's the map of Israel. More or less, this is a biblical map, meaning this is a map of cities in Tanakh, in Sefer Shmuel. Here's Beit Lechem. Here is Har HaZeitim, Yerushalayim. Here's the city of Nov. Can everybody see where I am? Here's Yerushalayim, Nachal Kidron. Okay, so if I zoom out from Yerushalayim, here's the city of Nov. Okay, what Shaul will eventually go and destroy is the city of Nov. And north of Yerushalayim is the territorial region of Shevet Binyamin. Here is Giv'ah, or Giv'at Binyamin, also known as Giv'at Shaul. Here is the city of Giv'on. Here is the city of Kiryat Ye'arim. Here is the city of Be'erot Binyamin. And here's the city of Beit Aven. And here, right? So if you remember the Giv'oni, the cities of the Giv'onim, Arei HaGiv'onim, were Giv'on, Kiryat Ye'arim, Be'erot, and Kfirim. Leave in Kfir for a second. Kiryat Yerim today is Telstone, north of Yerushalayim, northwest of Yerushalayim, I should say. Giv'on is here. Be'erot is here. So this area here, this ridge from Be'erot, Giv'on, and Kiryat Yerim, that's the territory of the Giv'onim. Okay, you with me? This is Yerushalayim, here is Givat Shaul. This is Shaul and the kingdom, the center of Shaul's Malchus. This ridge from Be'erot, Giv'on, and Kiryat Yerim belongs to the Giv'onim. Why is that relevant? Where is Michmas? Text tells me one thing about Michmas. Kidmat Beit Aven, east of Beit Aven, which would place us here. Now, if Michmas is here, what's the problem? Again, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yud Gimel and Yudal, Shaul fights an enormous force of the Plishtim in Michmas. What's the problem?
Someone had to let the Plishtim through.
Correct. The Plishtim are here. For the Plishtim to reach Michmas, the only way through is across the mountains and through the cities that belong to the Givonim, Giv'on and Be'erot. This is your Givonim bridge protection. And for 400 years, the Givonim had been allies with Israel. How did the Plishtim get to Michmas? Somebody had to let them in. And it is entirely possible that Shaul, after the Battle of Michmas, and after the victory was over, and the Plishtim ran, turns to the Givonim in a moment of wrath and says, you've lost your right to remain in this land. How dare you be neutral when the Plishtim are marching through? What did they say? They didn't get involved in the battle. We're not getting involved. This is between Israelites and the Plishtim. We're staying out of it. You can't stay out of it when you've got a 400-year-old breed. Either you're with us or you're not. So the most likely context for Shaul's wrath, zeal for Yisrael and Yehuda to exact retribution against the Givonim would have been in the aftermath of the Battle of Michmash, because there you literally see that there's no way for the Plishtim to have reached Michmash without going through the territory of the Givonim. I'll add one more interesting piece of information. In Perek Daled, in our parak, it says, after it tells us that Rechav and Ba'ana come from the city of Be'erot, which was considered a Binyaminite city because it's in the tribe of Binyamin, but it says that the Be'erotim ran. And where do they run to? Where do they run to? They ran to Gitaim and they remained there until today. Gitaim is here. Gitaim is in Eretz Plishtim. So the Be'erotim run to Eretz Plishtim. What are they running to Eretz Plishtim for? So again,
into a new Brit.
Right. So if the story is connected to the Battle of Michmash, or to Shaul's killing of the Givonim, then the story, the pieces of the puzzle come together. And then after the Battle of Michmash, Shaul turns his anger against the Givonim, and he says, the Plishtim are unreachable. I'm not going to pursue them. But how dare you let them through? And he exacts retribution against the Givonim, and he kills we don't know how many. And eventually the people of Be'erot have to run. They run to Gitaim. They say, well, listen, living in Israel under Shaul is untenable. We'd rather live under Plishtim. Not the first time somebody from Israel who found living under Shaul's reign untenable ran to Eretz Plishtim. Who else did that famously?
David.
Right. So the pattern is set. So that's a possibility, that ultimately that is where this story of the Givonim resides. So that's part one of the story. When does Shaul destroy the Givonim? Either the impact of the destruction of Nov, or just a general zeal for the clearing out of the Canaanites from the land, or what I'm suggesting is that it has some political context if he saw them aiding and abetting, or at least being neutral in their battle against the Plishtim. The biggest battle against the Plishtim in the early part of his reign was in Michmash, and there you see literally the landmass of the Givonim as the bridge between the Plishtim and Michmash. All right, in the 8 minutes that we have remaining, I want to begin to explore the question of why does the Navi, why does God consider this such a terrible crime that Shaul committed? Especially if we consider the political context of why Shaul did it, I think he has some justification. If the Plishtim were aided by the Givonim, then that's really an act of war. Like, why would you go to war against, why not punish the Givonim for that? Why does our Perek, at the end of Shmuel Bet, hold Shaul accountable for what he did to the Givonim? And that's really the big question. And we'll get to the moral question about if the Givonim if Shaul committed the crime, why punish the children and the grandchildren? That's another question, which we will get to. But why is this considered such a big crime? So I'm going to take you to the Radak for a minute. Radak says something very interesting. It says, the AFOP, Shenir'ah, ki lekavanah tova asah zeh Shaul. It would seem that Shaul had good intent in his actions against the Givonim, either because they're Canaanites or because he didn't trust the Shavua, or in our case, as we talked about, they're connected to the battle of the Plishtim. He's nonetheless punished for this act. Because Yeshua, who was a Navi, had given them status in the Mishkan. And to fulfill the Shavua that he had taken, the oath that he had taken, he didn't want to kill them. Even though this oath was taken on false pretense. But he didn't want to do it. So, because if you take an oath in God's name, even if it's an oath based on facts that are incorrect, but nonetheless, from the outside, you've taken a public oath in God's name. Everybody who hears it, what will they say? What will they say? They'll say, hey, look at this Yeshua guy. On the one hand, he takes an oath to allow them to stay and he makes an alliance with them. And then 3 days later, he kills them. That's a terrible Chilul Hashem. And they'll say, Ein Shvuat Hashem Chashuv Beinehem. They'll say that this guy, he doesn't hold oaths to be of any significance. Especially because these are oaths taken in God's name. The kosher can be made sure. How much more so? They've been in Israel for 400 years. You can't tell me that this is a fresh piece of politics. This is old. This is a policy that's been on the books for 400 years. Killing them would mean a terrible chilul Hashem. However, Shaul lo chashash l'chilul Hashem al ha-shvua. Shaul did not care, and he wasn't worried about the chilul Hashem that would be perceived for having violated an oath. L'fichach ne'anash zaro b'davar zeh, and that's why his children were killed or punished. We'll come to the children issue next week. I want to understand this chilul Hashem factor, especially if Shaul had political reasons to not trust the Givonim. If they stayed neutral in a battle against the Plishtim, if they allowed the Plishtim through, it's even more concerning. Why not punish them? They've shown that they're not as loyal as this oath would seem to be. Radak builds this entire interpretation on the assumption that there is a Chilul Hashem factor here for violating the oath of God.
Would you ever consult the Uri V'Tumim in that situation?
Oh, that's a very good question. Would you consult the Uri V'Tumim? What's the answer?
I'm going to assume that the answer is yes. Usually it's an act of war, right? If you, right, am I going to win the war? Should I engage in the war? So before he attacks.
Who is known most for engaging the Urim Batumim at every question, at every battle, and at every juncture?
David.
And who is known for insulting the Urim Batumim, for asking the Urim Batumim the question and then not having the patience to listen to the answer because he's made up his mind and he's going to do his own thing?
Shaul.
So the answer to your question is yes, you should consult with the Urim Batumim, but Shaul never does. And that's part of the problem.
But why is that not one of the, in any of these guys' answers?
Well, it sort of is. It's sort of in the broader context. One of the issues we dealt with was ultimately why that which brought down Shaul's whole malchus is this lax attitude towards Tvar Hashem in terms of the Navi, the Urim V'Tumim, the whole story of the soothsayer, the Baalat Ob at the end, is that the Urim V'Tumim is not speaking to him, the Navi is not speaking to him, he gets the silent treatment from God by the end of his malchus for that very reason. I want to show you something interesting in this context. Let's come back to this story. Shaul kills the Givonim, violates the oath that Yoshua had taken to the Givonim. The Givonim request of David 7 descendants. David has to agree because God had set this up for him to do whatever the Givonim had told him. We'll come back to that piece of it next week. But look at this pasuk. Vayachmol ha-melech ha-mefiboshet ben Yonatan ben Shaul. But even though he has to give 7 descendants of Shaul over to the Givonim, he'll give him descendants, he'll choose which ones, but he has compassion over Mephibosheth ben Yonatan and spares him. Why? Al Shvuat Hashem Asher Benatan ben David ben Yonatan ben Shaul. Because he had taken an oath in God's name to Yonatan. And you take an oath in God's name to you, you can't just disregard the oath. Is that interesting? The contrast here is between David's loyalty to his word, made an oath to Yoshua, to Yonatan, he made an oath to Shaul, that he would not destroy the house of Shaul, certainly made an oath to Yonatan, and he remains loyal to that oath, in contrast to Shaul, who did not remain loyal to that oath. In fact, of Shaul, an interesting pasuk, I alluded to this earlier. This is Shmuel Ala Perek Yitet. This is that Rosh Chodesh party. Eshma Shaul b'kol Yonatan v'yishava Shaul chai Hashem im yumat. Shaul says, I take an oath, Yonatan, by God, as God lives, David shall not be harmed. Okay, and the next day, he's in his house, he takes the spear, and he throws it at David, and David has to flee for his life. So between Pasuk Vav and Pasuk Yud, Shaul has violated his own oath. So there is, in this story, there is a clear contrast that is created for us, between the attitude that Shaul takes to not just the Urim V'Tumim, but to any word that invokes God's name. That's equivalent to the Urim V'Tumim. You take an oath in God's name, that's immutable. That's a shvua. And here he kind of just, I don't like the shvua. It doesn't suit me today. Whereas David, to the end of his life, is going to remain loyal to any word that comes out of his mouth, even to Yonatan in the sparing of Mephibosheth. So there is a contrast in this parak between the attitude of David and the attitude of Shaul. Like that in itself, that's a subtext of this whole story.
All right. Yeah, but where's the concept that if you do something wrong, it goes for X number of generations? Right?
So that we're going to explore as we explore the moral question, which is the next piece of this. Okay, so we've explored the political context of why Shaul decides to end his pact with the Givonim and chase them out of the land. We've explored the context of the impact that it has on sense of loyalty to a shvua that that Yoshua made, Shaul's attitude towards Shvuat Hashem altogether versus David. The last remaining question, which is the question that's going to lead us back to our parak, is the most important question of all, which is the moral question. Shaul killed the Givonim. How many years ago? This is David's reign. How many years ago did Shaul kill the Givonim? 12, 15, 20? right? And now, as David is king, there's a famine for 3 years that is killing Israelites because Shaul 30 years ago killed the Givonim. And you're going to appease God by appeasing the Givonim by killing 7 of Shaul's grandchildren 30 years later?
Are those grandchildren heirs to the throne?
No, they're dafka not heirs to the throne. We're going to see that as we explore that next week. If you look at who he hands over two of the children of Rizpah bat Aya. Veikach ha-melech et shnei b'nei Rizpah bat Aya. Rizpah bat Aya was whom?
Concubine.
He was Shaul's concubine. He was the one that Avner had taken that and that led to the rift between Avner and Yoav, between Avner and Ishbosheth. Back in Perek Gimel. Same Rizpah bat Aya was the subject of that rift between them. Rizpah bat Aya was Shaul's Pilegesh. Children of a Pilegesh are not heirs to the throne. So he takes two of the children of Rizpah bat Aya and Asher Yadah Shaul. And 5 of the children of, now this is a mistake, it's not Michal bat Shaul Asher Yadah Adriel ben Barzillai Mochalati, it's Merav. That we talked about last week, that Michal is not married to Adriel ben Barzillai. Merav is. Merav is the younger sister. Michal is the older sister. Merav is the younger sister. 5 of the children. Michal doesn't have any children. Michal is married to David. It's clearly it's Merav. Mefarshim all agree. Why it's called children of Michal? Michal had a hand in raising them, according to most of the Mefarshim. But be that as it may, these are children of Merav. So children of Merav are born to Adriel ben Barzillai Mocholati. They're not in line for the throne either. Adriel ben Barzillai is not from the house of Shaul. Merav is the younger daughter. Michal is the older daughter. She's married to David. These are not contestants for the throne. They're not in line for the throne. They have nothing to do with the throne. The only one that is a potential threat or a potential line for the throne is Mephibosheth, because he's the son of Yonatan. And he's the only one that David does not hand over to the Givonim. So he spares the children who are in line for the throne, and he hands over the children who are not in line for the throne. That's a very significant piece. And we'll come back to that next week. But what guilt do the children have in any of this? That's a question we have to explore. Because that's really the moral angst to this whole paragraph. So we're going to stop here with an address where we've addressed the question of what the story of the Givonim is. The last piece that we will, Bezrat Hashem, explore next week is how it links to the moral question of why exact this retribution on the children and grandchildren, number one, and how does that in any way bring us back to our parak, which is parak Dalid, namely the story of the murder of Ishbosheth by Rechav and Baana. So those are the two pieces of the story of Bezrat Hashem. The last two pieces will tie up in loose ends, which we shall do next week. And that is our discussion for tonight.
Fantastic.
All right. So I appreciate your time. And we will, Bezrat Hashem, continue next week at the same time.
Great. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Lala Tov.